This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and welcome to Health and Living with me, Lim Soo Ann. We often hear that you are what you eat, but does your diet affect your risk of stomach cancer? And really, when we're talking about the disease of stomach cancer, you know, who is at higher risk of stomach cancer, which is also known as gastric cancer? So joining me on the show today is consultant gastroenterologist Dato' Dr. Ryan Ponodure to help us better understand what it means to maintain good gut health and how it could help to reduce the risk of gastrointestinal cancers such as those in the stomach. Thank you so much for joining me today, Dr. Ryan.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure to have you on. Now, stomach cancer is not something that would seem to be as commonly spotlighted as other types of cancer. You know, I mean, we talk about breast cancers, lung cancers, those are the ones that people hear the most often. But when I looked at the Malaysian National Cancer Registry report from 2012 to 2016, which is the latest one that we have, it is actually among the top 10 cancers among men. So what can you actually tell us about the burden of this cancer in the Malaysian population?
So firstly, I want to say that, you know, when we talk about cancers, it's one of the most depressing topics to talk about. But the one thing I can say, though, with gastric cancers is that actually there's been a decrease in incidence. And for once, I can say that because, as you said, when we talk about the usual cancers like lung and colorectal and breast cancers, there's an increase and it's we see the alarming trajectory of an increase in these cancers. But in stomach cancers, fortunately, there's been a decrease from, say, 15 to 20 years ago to now. And the decrease has been about 30 to 40% compared to what it was before. Now, there has been studies done in Malaysia as well, looking at racial differences in the rates of gastric cancers. And we find that the Chinese have a higher proportion of stomach cancers as opposed to the Malays and the Indians. Now, if you look worldwide, you can see that the Japanese and the Koreans have the highest rates of stomach cancers. And we think that, you know, Japanese food, sushi, et cetera, is very healthy. And yet they're burdened with this horrible problem. And the Japanese have taken it five steps further, realizing how common it is in their population that they do yearly screening after the age of 40 because the burden is so high. And we figured it out that while we, and when I say we talk about the gastroenterology family, have figured out that one of the commonest reasons or risks is actually pickled food.
Oh, wow.
So like the Koreans like their pickled food and the Japanese as well. So that somehow, and with preserved food, seems to increase the risk of gastric cancer. So actually, with the advent of refrigeration, the rates of gastric cancers have actually dropped. And that's really interesting.
So, you know, in some cases, we see the rates of cancer increasing because people are more aware, people screen for it more, so you pick up more cases. But in the case of gastric cancer, is it because we're not screening enough, or is it because, like you say, that we have managed to reduce risk factors that lead to it?
Yeah, well, I think you hit all the points. Basically, this number one, the problem with stomach cancers, like some of these solid organ cancers, when I mean, when I talk about solid organ cancer, I'm talking about the GI tract cancers, is it's an insidious onset. In other words, I mean, it slowly creeps up on us. And before you know it, the tumor has spread. So similarly, in gastric cancers, the symptoms of gastric cancer comes in late. And what are those symptoms? Well, they are early satiety. What do I mean by that? Well, when a patient eats, they feel full over time and their appetites drop. So the warning signs in medicine as a doctor is what we call red flag signs. And it also is in gastric cancer. So early satiety, loss of weight, loss of appetite. These are things which are warning signs for the doctor that something else could be going on.
Any other common symptoms of stomach cancer besides these two?
Well, so as the cancer spreads, it starts causing local symptoms. What do I mean by local symptoms? So wherever the tumor is, it will cause a problem as it spreads. So the stomach is like a kidney bean shape. Mm-hmm. So if the tumor is on the higher part where the esophagus, the food pipe, enters the stomach, then the patient's going to have symptoms of difficulty swallowing. So the classic symptom is where the patient says, you know, doctor, in the last 3 months, I found that I can't seem to swallow my food so well. And now I'm taking more blended food, or I'm now going on to liquids. That's always not a good sign. Now, if the tumor is further down into the where the end of the kidney bean, where it enters into the intestine, if it blocks that part, the patient could have vomiting, where it blocks the pipe and the patient starts vomiting everything they eat. So that's another thing. And then we ask the patient, is it digested food versus undigested food? So all these are clear symptoms to us to try and figure out whether there's an actual mass or tumor blocking the stomach.
Now, these symptoms, Dr. Ryan, can sound quite familiar, right? I mean, they're not completely unusual if someone is feeling unwell. So at what point should someone be concerned? Because if, you know, you vomit once or twice, or you have a bit of difficulty swallowing, right? Like, for example, those things, when should you be worried?
Yeah. So I think I strategize by, as you said, symptoms. Age is another problem, another thing which I look at. Family history is another thing which alerts me, and lifestyle issues. So, for example, if a 20-year-old comes in with no family history, with no warning, as I mentioned, the red flags, no weight loss, just this fine of this bloating, discomfort, which I see almost every day, these kind of symptoms, then I strategize my treatment and investigations based on that, as opposed to a 60-year-old coming in with weight loss and, you know, let's say a family history of stomach cancer. These are the kind of cases where I would not, you know, that my threshold to do further tests is very low.
So would look at the risk factors that they have.
Absolutely. So age is a huge part. Now, again, you know, there's always outliers. For example, the horrible story of the 25-year-old who's diagnosed with a stomach cancer. But, you know, again, we have to look at cost effectiveness of treating. Mm-hmm. Do we screen all people coming in, or do we strategize according to symptoms and age and other risk factors? So, you know, sometimes we get caught out. And in medicine, we can never be so sure. So, you know, I mean, like all of us who have been in the business or in the profession long enough, we'll have cases where we've missed because we didn't realize that this can happen at these kind of ages, young age, and we could have been more aggressive at that time. But if you look at a population as a whole and the burden on healthcare, we need to be able to strategize what treatments are right to do and how quickly we should do it and so on.
Before we get more into, I guess, screening options and those sort of things, Dr. Ryan, I understand that there are different types of stomach cancer as well. Could you elaborate more on that and, I guess, what's happening in the stomach, you know, depending on which type of cancer someone has?
Fortunately, God made our GI tract quite simple in the sense that it's quite standard, where you have kind of three layers which line the whole GI tract from the mouth to the anus. So basically, a cancer develops when the cells mutate. And when they mutate, they form these lesions which can occur. And when we talk about the stomach, it depends on the type of mucosal layer. I don't want to get into too much technicalities, but the classic cancer of the stomach is called an adenocarcinoma. So for those in the audience listening, carcinoma is the term we use for cancer. So adenocarcinoma is a type of cell in the stomach which develops into a tumor, a cancer. A tumor in medicine just means a growth. So a tumor could be benign or malignant. But when we say cancer, we mean malignancy. So adenocarcinoma is the classic type of stomach cancers which can happen. Now, there are other types called lymphomas. Lymphomas are cancers of the white cells. And they can form certain mucosal-associated lymphomas, which are associated with a bacteria called Helicobacter pylori. Now, I think a lot of the people in the audience would have heard of this bacteria called Helicobacter pylori, which we have gone on a crusade in the last 40 years to eradicate. Helicobacter pylori has had a bad name because it is an association. It is an association with stomach cancers. But I want to advise people that we have to take it in context as well. A lot of people come horrified that they have Helicobacter pylori and think they're going to get cancer. But actually, the percentage of people with H. pylori who develop stomach cancers are less than 0.3%. But when we do detect cancers, we do see an association with Helicobacter pylori, and especially in the lymphoma type cancers of the stomach.
Picking up on something you mentioned earlier, Dr. Ryan, about pickled food, right? How much does our diet actually contribute to potential risk factors for stomach cancer?
Yeah, so there are, I mean, looking at on a worldwide basis, there are certain types of food which we take definitely predispose you to certain cancers. Now, I'll give you another example of, there's a certain part of Thailand in a place called Konkan, which has the highest rates of liver cancer, bile duct cancer, based on a certain type of fish they eat. Oh. It's a raw fish. And it's a river fish, which it's quite prevalent in that part of Thailand. And by ingesting that, you get this liver fluke, which results in a liver cancer. Now, so there is a definite association of what you eat and a chance of getting certain types of cancers. When we go back to the stomach, we do know the pickled variety can lead to a higher rate of stomach cancers. As far as other things, obviously, certain other pathogens like smoking, when you inhale that smoke into the stomach, you are going to cause a higher risk and chance of mutation of the cells and a higher rate of stomach cancers. So alcohol as well can cause what we call an alcohol-associated gastritis, which is an inflammation of the stomach. And I think the rate of increase of stomach cancers do go up. But if you have the classic foods, if you're high in vegetables, all the good things which your mother tells you to take, you're going to be fine.
So if you're eating a balanced diet, even if you have a even if you like your pickled food a bit too much, that's still okay?
Yeah, I think, you know, everything, you know, it's the safest thing I can say is everything in moderation. So I have patients who go, look, can I have a glass of wine in the evenings? Yes, you can. I mean, but you've got to take things in moderation. The main problems which patients face me every day is the bloating and the abdominal discomfort. Now, how do we dissociate that from a cancer? The problem is, like when you started this interview, was that the symptoms are vague. You know, it's all like a Venn diagram that's all intermeshed with bloating, abdominal discomfort. Do we start investigating those kind of cases? Well, majority of these cases are due to lifestyle. In other words, your regularity of your meals, your caffeine intake, you know, if you take 5 cups of coffee a day, that could cause a lot of acid reflux. All these things are the most likely cause. Are these things, could you have a cancer? It's highly unlikely. And that's why, you know, when we talk about gastric cancer, we talk about all these cancers, these are not, I mean, it's not common, but these are things we need to be aware of. Most of the symptoms are actually benign, thank God, and can be treated by basic lifestyle changes.
All right, we'll go for a quick break now, Dr. Ryan, and continue our discussion when we come back. I'm speaking to Dr. Ryan Ponodure, consultant gastroenterologist, about stomach cancer, also known as gastric cancer. And while this may not be as common as some of the other cancers that we hear about, as Dr. Ryan just said, it's important to be aware of it. We'll continue our discussion after a quick break, so keep it here on Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, Lim Soo Ann. We are talking about stomach cancer today, also known as gastric cancer, together with consultant gastroenterologist, Dr. Ryan Ponodure. Now, before the break, we were talking about the incidence of it here in Malaysia, the risk factors that increases someone's risk of stomach cancer, and that includes things like age. Men are more prone to it as well. There's also lifestyle factors to be accounted for, things like diet, whether you smoke, your weight and things like that. But of course, everything has to be looked at in totality. No one single thing usually predisposes you to it. Dr. Ryan, picking up on what you were talking about, our GI tract, right? A lot of these, because of stomach cancer is linked and part of this whole gastrointestinal tract, I understand that these symptoms could also be shared with other types of cancers along the GI tract. Is that right?
Absolutely correct. And I think it's a good question. I think, Suan, basically, the patients, again, I categorize patients according to age. Age is always, to me, the indication for me how aggressive I should be. So when a patient comes in with vague symptoms of bloating and abdominal discomfort, it could range, and now we talk about the cancer symptoms. These kind of symptoms, it could be mimicking a pancreatic tumor, a colon tumor, mm-hmm. a duodenal tumor, stomach cancer, or even an esophageal cancer. So the bottom line is the symptoms which patients present can be so vague, mm-hmm. and so interspersed with other types of cancers that it's really hard to categorize it and classify it into like a box and say, oh, this is stomach, or this is colon, or this is pancreas. And this is a big mistake we can make as a doctor, and that we compartmentalize symptoms and say it can't be anything else. So what I do as a doctor is that, you know, when a patient comes in front of me and I'm concerned, I have really three modes of investigations. Number one, obviously, besides the history of what the symptoms are, number one is blood tests. The blood tests, which people do outside as well, give me an idea and gives me a direction of which way to go if there's something is abnormal. Mm. Number two is an imaging test. How can I image this whole area? Well, that's where radiology comes in. And what we have as far as a means to check would be a simple ultrasound of the abdomen or a CT scan. And the last thing is to look. And that is what I do, which is endoscopy. I can do an endoscopy, like an upper scope, to look for stomach cancers. It takes me only about 3 to 4 minutes to do under sedation, mm-hmm. and allows me to check the lining. So these are the three things which are open to me to explore when a patient presents with these vague symptoms.
Because the symptoms are so vague, you know, when do patients usually present to you? I guess, and what I'm trying to get at is when are patients usually diagnosed with stomach or gastric cancer if they have it?
Yeah. So the good thing about 2023 now and the last 5 years is that people are now quite open to health screening. Mm-hmm. There are many health screening centers around Malaysia where they do this battery of blood tests and scans. Now, there are pros and cons to that. Let me advise you on this. Why I say there are pros and cons is because in these health screen tests, they do these cancer markers. Mm-hmm. And everyone is fixated on cancer markers.
Yes.
And even just today, I've had two or three patients who are stressed out because the little cancer marker is elevated. And we do all these incredible tests to prove that they don't have a cancer. You see, I need this to be emphasized, and if there's one take-home message in this whole talk, mm-hmm. is that we must be very careful with cancer markers. Number one, cancer markers do not rule out cancer. Number two, only certain cancer markers are really advised, and one of them would be in men would be a prostate-specific antigen, PSA. But the rest, the CEAs for colon cancer, the CA19-9s for pancreatic or biliary cancers, these are being used inappropriately. Mm-hmm. We use these when patients have cancer, and then we check it, and then we treat, and then we check to see of a response to treatment. Unfortunately, patients are insisting that they get these, and they're comforted by normal markers, but that doesn't mean that they could not have a cancer. And this is the dilemma we're facing. We're facing, number one, an overconfidence in these blood tests. Number two, a stressed out patient because the blood test is slightly abnormal.
And that's really not helpful, isn't it? Because you want patients to, on the one hand, you want patients to take ownership over their health, but on the other hand, you want them to do it properly with the correct information.
Absolutely. And that's where Google does not help. Because now they have a slightly elevated CEA or mm-hmm. CA19-9. And they Google it and they think they've got 6 months to live, you see. So this is the problem with what we are facing. So I know there's a cancer, everyone's worried about the big C. But, you know, I think tumor markers, you've got to be careful with. For me, it's the blood test I'm talking about is the full blood counts, you know, looking at the hemoglobin, looking at the liver function test, looking at the kidney function. These are the simple blood tests I look at. The scans, I love an ultrasound of the abdomen because it's non-invasive, it's relatively cheap, and it gives us a lot of information on the liver, the pancreas, and so on. So that's another great test to have done.
And I guess if we could move on to treatment, right? What are the options like for patients with stomach cancer? Because I guess in the sense with this organ, some, for some people, it might be difficult to imagine how you would remove a tumor, right? Because it's attached to your gastrointestinal system.
Lining. Well, okay. So basically early detection. Now we go, as we talk, I'm saying one thing, not to do too many tests. Now I'm saying, yes, early detection. So, but honestly, as we all can understand, early detection allows you the best survival. Mm-hmm. So if you pick up a tumor in stage one, like a stomach cancer, you have about a 60% 5-year survival, as opposed to a stage four, where it's spread everywhere and you've got a less than 20% 5-year survival. So obviously, you need to get the patient early. Now, lining stage one means it's involving just the lining of the stomach, has not infiltrated through into the muscle layer. Mm-hmm. Now, this allows the gastroenterologist to remove it endoscopically. This would be the ideal scenario, where we get them in early and we can endoscopically remove this growth, send it to the lab, make sure the margins are clear, and then follow on with very close screening. The Japanese are the best at this. They've developed an incredible technique which allows them to dissect out this area. And because of their experience and the number of cancers they see in the early detection, they're able to do it that way. Mm-hmm. So that is the ideal scenario. Now, most, as you mentioned earlier in our discussion, most patients present late. Mm-hmm. Now, we are talking about stage 3 to stage 4. This is where a simple endoscopic removal will not work. This is where we need to get a multimodality approach. What do I mean by that? Well, we need a team. Mm-hmm. Who is in that team? Well, it's the gastroenterologist who makes the diagnosis by biopsying. The second one is the oncologist, who will then decide on the mode of treatment. And the lastly, and the most important, is the surgeon, mm-hmm. who will decide on what kind of removal and what needs to be dissected and resected out.
In those cases, if parts of the stomach have to be dissected or removed, right, what does care look like post-surgery? How does it affect patients' ability to eat, to digest food?
Yeah, so this you're basically asking what is the quality of life and what kind of treatments available from a surgical perspective. Again, it depends on the area of involvement. Now, if it's higher up in the stomach near the esophagus, this is a horrible area to have it, because then they have to remove a lot of the esophagus, at least half of the stomach, and then do a pull-up into the chest. It sounds horrible, but can be done laparoscopically, which means by keyhole surgery. It does involve, it isn't a major operation, and it also involves lymph node removal. So The Japanese are at the forefront of this treatment, where they painstakingly dissect every lymph node around the stomach and remove it, so that the chance of, and that gives you the best staging and also the best chance of cure. If the tumor is in the middle or lower part of the stomach, then the total gastrectomy, that's what it's called, where the whole stomach is removed and the intestine is joined up to the esophagus. Quality of life is actually not so bad. Of course, there's issues with diarrhea and so on after the procedure, but patients can live a reasonably healthy and fulfilling life. The treatment from the oncologist is a chemo radiation type approach. Sometimes what is needed is that they downstage the tumor with what we call neoadjuvant chemo radiation, and then it's resected out. So a lot of times, how we do, what is really important is to stage the cancer properly before treatment. And the staging involves another procedure which I do a lot of, which is called endoscopic ultrasound. So I am able to put the scope into the stomach under regular sedation, and then I scan around the stomach looking for lymph nodes or fluid, which might indicate that it's a stage 4 cancer. Because by knowing the stage, we can then do the right treatment. You don't want to go in thinking it's a small a stage one and then finding out it's stage four because the treatment approach is different.
And that way you ensure the best quality of life for the patient
as well.
That's
right. Absolutely. So nowadays with endoscopic ultrasound, with CT scans, with PET scans, all these allow us to do a customized or tailored approach for the patient. Because nowadays with the oncologic treatment drugs, we can actually shrink down these tumors and then do the right treatment.
Now, part of this discussion on cancer treatment, Dr. Ryan, is always the worry that patients go looking for traditional and alternative treatments. Is that an added concern for stomach cancer patients, especially if they are consuming such medicines?
Yeah. So this is a good question. Now, I am, you know, living and working in Malaysia, we have a huge body of patients who believe in traditional medications, believe in the fact that if it comes from the earth or ground, it's considered safe. Now, again, I think it's really important, having trained in Western medicine, that we do not put down traditional medicines because, you know, like Ayurvedic, like the Chinese traditional medicine, these have gone back 2,000 years, etc. Mm-hmm. And the problem with Western medicine, or should I say people who work in a Western medical world, is that we believe medications which are tested in randomized controlled trials.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with the Chinese herbal meds, etc., and Ayurvedic, is that we don't have randomized trials. Does that mean it's wrong? No, but how do I advise people who come in with a plant in their hand saying, this is what I take for good health living? Well, you know, I worked in Selayang and it's a liver center, and I still remember a whole ward of patients who had different shades of yellow because they took herbal meds and their livers did not react very well to it. So, you know, you've got to be very careful when we talk about herbal meds, etc. Just because it's herbal does not make it non-toxic to the liver. So I think, yes, there's a body there which a lot of meds, but I think in this day and age, you know, if you believe on targeted therapy and the latest in chemotherapy, I mean, I would go with that and first.
Let's talk about screening, Dr. Ryan. You mentioned earlier how the Japanese have introduced this system where they recommend screening for men aged 40 and above. But here in Malaysia, for example, what's the recommendation for people? You know, who should go for screening? How often should they?
Right. So, you know, we have looked at screening procedures for colon cancer. Everyone now is getting more and more familiar with colonoscopy for colon cancer. We know about mammograms for breast cancer. We know about pap smears for cervical cancer. But we have not instituted a guideline for gastric cancer because as I mentioned, the incidence has actually dropped. So I think as a gastroenterologist, I go on the risk factors of age and family history, and of course, warning signs like, as I mentioned, difficulty swallowing, etc. So if a patient comes in who's 45 and above, my threshold for doing an upper endoscopy based on symptoms is very low. Now, if you're 20 years old and you have this vague symptoms of bloating and discomfort, I would probably do a breath test looking for Helicobacter pylori and then treat based on that. But if you're 45 and above, I think the American guidelines are quite clear on the fact that you would look before treatment. So a 20-year-old, how likely is a 20-year-old to have a stomach cancer as opposed to a 50-year-old with similar symptoms? So that's where I go on that. You know, so most times for the young patients, I would treat, I would not check. But on the older age patients, I would definitely consider doing an endoscopy to look.
So if it's endoscopy, which means that your regular, I guess, screening packages, those wouldn't necessarily be focused on things like stomach cancer, right? And your cancer markers don't necessarily tell you much.
Yeah. So I would not, I mean, you know, it's extremely hard to say everyone at this age, like what I would do in colonoscopy, I would say 45 and above, do your colonoscopy. Mm. I can't really say that in the stomach because we don't have data to support it. But I would say if you are of that age group with a family history with definitely I would consider doing an endoscopy based on your risk factors.
All right. And to wrap up our conversation today, Dr. Ryan, what would be your takeaway message for our listeners when it comes to stomach cancer?
I think number one, I think you got to be careful what you read in Google. Mm-hmm. Number two is to do the right tests at the right time. Now, again, that's not easy to do, but I think what people are doing, which is right, is to do a health screen. I think a health screen of regular blood tests and ultrasound on a yearly basis when you hit 40 and above is a good idea. I think if you have you've got to be aware, if you have a family history of certain cancers, what your risk is for that type of cancer. So for breast cancer, for colon cancer, we know there's a genetic link. Stomach cancers, and even pancreatic cancers. I think the genetic element to cancers is very high. And so that is something you need to be aware of. So I think everyone has to take ownership of themselves and what importance it is to do the tests. So I think, get your health screen, get your stress test done, get all these things done, and then you can lead a long and happy life.
And on that note, thank you so much for joining me today, Dr. Ryan.
Thank you.
I've been speaking to Dr. Ryan Bonodure, consultant gastroenterologist, about stomach cancer, also known as gastric cancer. I'm Lim Sun, and this has been Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.